Well, sometimes they have to kill us. They have to kill us. Because they can't break our spirit.
Look, I don't have to do this.
You don't have any choice.
I'm trying to help you people. Now, why won't you accept that?
It's in our DNA. You have to do what old man says.
What makes you such a threat?
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power, Ray.
Prophecy Keepers Radio.
This is Joss Ogonie, Will Bluewater, a seventh great grandson of Samanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anahuacis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. OCO, Ginalii, this is Blue Otter coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the Cherokee Nation.
Beginning of Part 1. Please refer to program notes for the scheduled date and time of Part 2. Thank you for supporting Prophecy Keepers Radio with your tax-deductible offerings to the Oklava Native American Church of the White Roots of Peace.
With us is our favorite host, Bluewater.
Hello, everybody, OCO.
So, anyhow, hello, Ron.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Anyhow, I'm going to let you and Bluewater talk for a few minutes, and then I'll be right back, okay?
You bet. We'll do a little bit of reminiscing here. I met Ron, I guess it's been about 2 or 3 years ago, at a gathering here in Missouri. Actually, I guess I'd met him online previous to that. He came over to a gathering, and he, basically what he had done, he's an archaeologist, and he had done some studies of places in North Central I guess what North and in Central America and Mexico, right, Ron?
Well, yeah. The study has gotten a little more focused on the United States, but I did initially do a study of sacred sites throughout Mesoamerica and South America.
Right. And the thing that was that'll shock most people is that once you drew lines in between places where a certain number of Indian mounds were, you found out that there were a five-pointed star that would connect them, and once you got up to places where there were seven mounds or more, it was a perfect five-pointed upright star. So, you know, and that lets you take off.
Sure. It was sort of an evolutionary process. I had found an interesting codex that had come from a cave in Trinidad back in the 1500s. It was something Spanish explorers had discovered, and it went back to Spain, rubbing of it, and was lost in an archive for hundreds of years. And when I finally found the Trinidad Codex, I looked at it and thought, well, this seems really important. It has so much information coded into it that I should attempt to decode it, and really didn't have much success with that. And I have two daughters, and they were quite young at the time, 7 and 9 years old, and my younger daughter asked me, well, where is Trinidad, Dad? And so we got the maps out and started plotting out all the locations on the planet called Trinidad, and I started seeing if there was a connection between the layout of these sites and simply drew a line between them. I think ultimately we found about 18 locations. And there was a parallel pattern. It started down at the tip of South America, came up all along the western seaboard, and through Central America into North America. And interestingly, the Trinidads in North America, when you connected the dots with a line, made a star-shaped pattern. It was inverted sideways, you know, but it was still there. And over a period of time, you know, I thought this was interesting, did more research and was looking a bit into the Mayan legend of El Dorado and the seven golden cities of Cibola. Has some connection to the area I live in the middle of the United States when Coronado came through here in search of those golden cities. So just out of curiosity, I charted all the locations on a map that were named El Dorado, and came up with seven of them. And once again, when you connected the dots with a simple line on a map, they made a star-shaped pattern. And when we observed that the Trinidad star pattern and the El Dorado star pattern both pointed to the same place in the middle of America, I thought there was some kind of connection there, because the name of that location was Mounds. So I set out and charting all the mound locations that I could find, and that was pretty difficult because there isn't a good reference or database in historical archives or geological survey on the location of these mound sites. So it took several attempts to come up with good longitude-latitude coordinates, but ultimately I did chart well over 300 mound locations in the United States.
That's amazing. Well, the thing that really shocked me, Ron, was when you told me that, now, it was El Dorado's expedition that was the most far-flung or archaeological expedition in history, right?
Of all time. It's amazing. You know, just to make it from Spain to the United States in the 1500s was quite a sea journey.
And to talk the crown into coming up with the money, they had to have some pretty compelling evidence to open up the purse.
That evidence came from an earlier expedition of Cabeza de Vaca when he made his journey to the United States, or to the Americas. He was a lesser captain in a fleet of seven ships, and they ran into bad weather in the Gulf of Mexico. Five of the vessels grounded outside the Mississippi Delta area. And Cabeza de Vaca was able to keep his ship afloat all the way until he got to Corpus Christi, where it ran aground and killed all hands but three other members. He was forced to live among the natives and take on a shamanistic lifestyle, and wandered throughout North America for 8 years before he finally found a Spanish settlement. And during that time, the Native American shaman befriended him because he had taken on this medicine path, and ultimately exposed one of the cities, these secret Cibola sites, to him. So when he was returned with his compatriots, Spaniards, and told these wild stories, they thought he had lost his mind, and he and his shipmates were sent to China at hard labor. Francisco de Coronado had heard the tale and had him summoned back to Spain and brought before the crown, and this is what helped convince the king and queen to fund Coronado's expedition to the Americas.
It's an amazing story. Now, would that have been the Atacapans that he found himself among down there in coastal Texas? Because they're a pretty fierce, big, tall bunch of Indians.
Carancas and a number of those tribes, and they were pretty playful tricksters, you know, and as you say, 7 foot, 7.5 feet tall.
Mm-hmm, yeah, they were known as man-eaters.
I don't know if they actually did anything like that, but nevertheless, you know, part of their culture dealt with all the bayou life, you know, and, I mean, they would kill alligators and render the fat and mix it with mud and cover it on their bodies as a mosquito repellent, because they were pretty voracious mosquitoes.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, I imagine it was a bit of a fumey potion.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, you know, he made it all the way into New Mexico and Arizona and into the, you know, those regions there where he met Anasazi. And I think perhaps in Acoma was one of the sites he was allowed to access.
Oh, my word.
Now, I think it was about 3 years ago, archaeologists were working with the Acoma Indian tribes and did discover a lost city or some sort of civilization in one of these underworld locations.
Mm-hmm. They do have some caves, I heard.
Mm-hmm. And at that point, the archaeologists were removed from the project and the medicine men took over.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know,
so are you saying that there was underground, they had underground cities?
Yes.
That they were living in?
Right. And I think this was the misperception that Coronado had, having come up through Mexico and seen monumental pyramids and vast remnants of these huge cultures that had flourished for thousands of years and had vast riches and fortunes and gold. You know, some of the pyramids down there even had gold pipe in them. They were looking for that sort of evidence when they came into North America. So this journey took them over 9,000 miles winding around until they wound up in the middle of Kansas in the winter of 1551, I believe it was.
That's amazing.
We've currently, you know, been engaging in some field archaeology. I came back from a site today where we had discovered a Spanish cross by Coronado that was etched into the side of a cliff, about 2 feet tall and a foot wide, and incised a good 6 inches into the cliff face. And only found it because we rappelled off the cliff and cut the tree roots and pulled the moss down and found that and a large dove carved into the stone.
Oh, my word. Now, who was it that came up the Mississippi River to what is now the boothill of Missouri?
We were talking about DeSoto there.
Yeah, I guess it was DeSoto. He apparently was looking for something, too, because he wandered all throughout, meandering all throughout Missouri and Arkansas.
Mm-hmm. And frequently when he encountered these mound cultures, they had a queen instead of a chief hierarchy. They had a female queen. And the mounds typically housed some kind of altar or house, you know, at the top that they kept pearls in. And, of course, they kept giving these to the explorers, you know, as they came. Ultimately, I think he was so laden with them that he just couldn't transport them anymore. The Indians would come in and raid their campsites at night and set fire to their tents.
No.
So that they weren't able to hold on to it.
That's fun.
Well, I know that Indians down in the Southwest used to do that, like especially around the with the Peraltas. You know, in the Superstition Mountains, they would be transporting gold or whatever and be attacked by the Indians, and the Indians would scatter the gold or take it someplace where it couldn't be found.
Mm-hmm.
So that would make sense that these Indians would do the same thing.
Yeah, we read many legends of, you know, expeditions that you know, ran into trouble somewhere along the way and cached the wealth and left it behind, you know, so there's just an abundance of archaeological remnants left behind. We are finding carvings. Well, today there was one in the 1500s that we found, and another one that was a 1777 date. So,
before we get too far along, I want to tell folks, you have made a video. It's called The Mystery of Mound Matrix, and it's $14.95 as a donation to the Cave Springs Foundation. And the address is Cave Springs Foundation, Incorporated, 730.
Let me give you a new address.
Oh, okay.
Just to speed things up, it would be to 3542 Southwest Fulton, F-U-L-T-O-N. And, of course, you know, there is a link on the website where, you know, if you click on it and order it through there, then I'll automatically get an email message that sends me your address.
Oh, the bottom left-hand corner of the PayPal donate.
Right. And that's a real simple process. And then it sends me an email with the person who's inquiring their address, and then I'll ship that out automatically. But just to run that address again, is 3542 Southwest Fulton, F-U-L-T-O-N, in Towanda, Kansas, T-O-W-A-N-D-A, Kansas, 67144.
And it's outstanding production. It's very, very interesting. I recommend it to anybody. I guess he was looking for... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say I recently relocated to Towanda for a new project we're doing here, researching. This is an ancient Indian settlement. Towanda actually means rushing water because of the water that used to rush from the cave underneath the town here. Of course, I'm out in the rural area, but... an amazing story of a huge dome that was sealed off in the 1880s, and so we're conducting a research project to find the old entrances and to gain access into this huge system that's underneath. The lake itself, once you're 80-100 feet down, you have to cross a 600-foot-long lake, and then you begin traversing the passageways.
Huh.
Just a huge system, and it's never been charted or explored in modern times. So that's the goal why we relocated for this current project.
That's amazing. Well, he was looking above ground and should have been looking underground.
That's exactly right. You know, the metaphor for cibola actually means onion.
Peel the layers away.
And the fruit is in the earth.
Yeah, the onion parable, the more layers you peel back, the more truth you'll find. And it was absolutely amazing what the Mount, what was here when the Mount culture was at its height. And of course, their reasons, you know, were had a lot to do with greed. But if it wasn't for their records, we wouldn't know a whole heck of a lot of about what they did. So I guess we really have them to be thankful for.
Now, these Mounds people were here before the Native Americans, am I correct?
You know, it's a very difficult question. Modern archaeology attributes the Mounds directly to the woodland cultures and says that they're between 1,500 and 3,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Archaeologically, cultures go back much farther than that. In Kansas, unfortunately, most of the archaeology gets done due to highway projects when they run into Native burials. They bring in the archaeological teams to do a recovery and turn the remains over to the NAGPER organizations or the Unmarked Burial Site Review Boards, but a very ineffectual method of actually, you know, doing a study. I'm thinking of one in southern Kansas where the dig pits went to 6 feet and they exhausted the culture that they were investigating, which were quapaws, means coon eyes, because it would paint a black stripe across their eyes. But they discovered they were beginning to find remnants of an even older culture below that. And the county I'm in now is called Butler County in Kansas, and the historical record shows the archaeological remains of native cultures go down 50 feet, which would predate the pyramids of Egypt. So, you know, to attribute the mounds directly to one culture, yes, I believe that's absolutely true because of the pattern anomalies that come out of it, since they are laid out in specific geometric patterns. You know, that's scientifically provable, you know.
Well, I think that it's kind of a shame. I guess archaeology ebbs and flows with what's politically correct. And the first book, I guess, that was written on the subject was The Traditions of Dikuda by William Pidgeon. And it was the book that first introduced the idea of magnetic grid lines or ley lines to the world. It was written in 1853, and I recently lucked out and got a copy.
Oh, my.
But it's but his what he had reported has pretty much been poo-pooed because it's unpopular nowadays to suggest that some other cultures other than Indians built the mounds, and that's kind of fallen out of style. But I think the truth is probably somewhere in between, because I know, according to the Catula, original Catula Society of Nighthawks, the Cherokee and their second invasion up here about 1,500 years ago encountered them, warred with them, and intermarried with them, and our people tend to be quite a bit taller, but we understand that they were lighter skinned than we were, and supposedly that accounts for why our women are quite a bit lighter than our men. And but they were different. You know, it's a little hard to tell from a grave what color people were, but...
Prophecy Keeper, Prophecy Keeper.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
OCO is Cherokee for hello. This is Chia Sagonige, also known as Will Bluewater. I'm the International Communications Director for the Cherokee Nation of Mexico. I'm speaking on behalf of the seven clans and beloved woman Sharon Rogers, wife of Chief Priest and Principal Chief Charles L. Yatlohi Rogers, M.D., oncologist. Their family discovered the tomb in Mexico of Sequoia, the world-famous inventor of the Cherokee alphabet and the namesake of the Cherokee National Forest in California. The state of Oklahoma was very nearly named the state of Sequoia. Nación Cherokee de Mexico, the Cherokee Nation of Mexico, is known in the United States as the Cherokee Nation of Sequoia of Mexico, Texas, and the USA Reservation and Church. Free of any charge, we are accepting citizenship and adoption applications not only from Cherokee descendants, but from all people of good heart from all lineages, just as we did for the 10,000 plus years before the United States government fairly recently imposed restrictions on Cherokee citizenship. Tennessee Governor Sam Houston had not one drop of Cherokee blood, yet he left office and later became Kalanu, or Speaker of Council, second only to Chief John Jolly of the Cherokee Nation West. The Republic of Mexico has recognized the Cherokee four times since the 1700s, and Spain five times before that. We possess original physical copies of all those treaties. In January of 2001, the San Andres Accords, enabling government-to-government tripartite relationships between sovereign Indian nations and the government of Mexico, were passed by the Mexican Congress. A few weeks later, the first such sovereign Indian nation, Nación Cherokee de México, was federally recognized in a solemn ceremony in Torreón, the capital of the state of Coahuila, formerly known as the province of Coahuila in Texas. The ceremony was followed by a fabulous celebration, which was attended by Cherokee elders from all over the Americas, including citizens of the federally recognized Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, people like Squaw Yee, the famed bowmaker, Al Heron. There is so much more to share with you, so I encourage you to visit our website at CherokeeDiscovery.com. While you are visiting the website, feel free to fill out a free citizenship application. Please be patient, though. We have no paid staff, and applications may take up to 9 months or more to get processed. If you're not a Cherokee, feel free to request adoption. And please don't forget, tell them Bluewater sent you. Ski. Wado.
I did a news story with the local ABC affiliate, and standing in front of the mouth of the cave, and when we played it back in slow motion, these balls of light were flying out of the cave behind me, and this was ABC News who shot this.
It's not my word.
So there were so many phenomena. You could go in the cave and someone would tap you on the shoulder and you'd turn around, there'd be no one there.
Now, they've talked about that down there at the Mammoth Cave in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a great story about the Mammoth Cave. Initially, it was just a guy out hunting rabbits. He shot and wounded a rabbit. It crawled into a hole, and he felt compelled not to leave the animal to suffer. So he crawled into the hole, and he discovered a cave that was 700 feet long and about 60 feet deep. today they've charted that cave, and it's called the Flint Bridge System now because it connects two mountains, and it's 640 miles long and goes 700 feet deep.
Well, there has also been a legend that that is one of the entrances to Shambhala.
To the underworld.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are explorers who have claimed to have gone into the Southwest and come up in northern South America. You know, that there's an entire network of systems. Tal Levesque is one of the researchers who's done a great deal of this, the interconnected systems. In my mapping, when I map the caves in the western United States, starting up in Montana and Wyoming and some of those where they have the Whistling Cave and the Blowing Cave and the Wind Cave, when you map them out, they have perfectly straight lines in parallel running from north to south all the way to Mexico.
Well, no, your ley lines run straight, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ley lines, I should say.
A friend of mine posited that during times of even flooding, that, well, it's kind of like if you were to take a glass of, just a drinking glass, and you hold it upside down and, you know, press it down into a bathtub, you know, there's going to be air in there, and the same would be true, say, if people knew a flood was coming, and they're able to go down to the point where they could come back up again and be protected by the pressure of air from a flood.
And Mayan cave burials are done specifically on that theory that you just said. They have these rooms that are up and above the system that they know those bones will forever be preserved and kept dry. Because,
right.
You know, they have these other chambers up and above the system.
Yeah, Thomas Mills will be talking about that. He's the one that wrote the book The Truth, which points out that the only animal symbols on the Giza Plateau are the symbols that are the most important to the Hopi religion, that is almost devoid of animal symbols except for Hopi religious symbols, and that the Great Pyramid may have been an escape place from flooding because the entrances are down low, and you go down, and but then once you're down in the pyramid, you can go up, which would keep you give you a chance to survive, and that is indeed what he says is that several couples the culture knew the flood was coming. Several couples were prepared, food was prepared, and that in the Great Pyramid there's even the instructions on how to survive. And so that'll be an exciting show coming up in a few weeks.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we have this image of the pyramids and the sand and everything, but that's not what it was like back then. You know, it was a lush, heavy vegetated area with lots of rainfall, and it was a beautiful, lush climate. The term alchemy comes from the Chem Valley. You know, the every year the Nile would flood and bring in all these silts, which would turn it black, and that's what made it so fertile, you know, is that it brought all the nutrients to the plants. And the Arab Al-Jabir went to Egypt and worked with the pharaohs, excuse me, and developed algebra and many of the other metallurgical sciences, you know, and that's where the term originated, alchemy and algebra and all that, from this, you know, early investigation.
That's absolutely amazing.
Now, why did you call it, why are you calling your site Mound Matrix? I'm curious about the matrix part, what your beliefs are there.
It is a matrix, a grid pattern that is geometrically laid out based on the phi ratio. And suppose I should go into that a little bit. The phi ratio is a mathematical of 1.62.
Oh.
It's actually 1.618171523.
Right.
But what we find in nature is that there is a mathematical formula that things are created based on. And to me, this is defining God herself, you know, that creation actually uses a set provable mathematical formula in creating things. So you take your index finger and you look at the three segments of the joints, and some are longer and shorter than the others, but two segments are 1.62, the ratio of one segment. This is also the basis of the Fibonacci numerical series, where it's 1, 3, 5, 8. You know, you take the previous number and add it to the last one, and you get your next digit. That's all got the phi ratio built into it. And the best example of this is the pentagram, or the five-pointed star, is geometrically created by using the phi ratio. I mean, you could just take a simple compass and set it at any setting you like and draw a round circle and take that same width that you have now and make a mark at the top and put your pinpoint there and make another mark and go around and do that five times and simply connect those vertices and you have a five-pointed pentagram. You've perfectly dissected or pentsected that circle into five points. And what's beautiful about it is in the middle you get a pentagon. And there again you merely connect the vertices and you get another pentagram. So that's what happens in the pattern of the mound matrix when you connect the dots of, you know, these sites, that you get these star-shaped patterns.
Someone might be able, here's a perfect example of it, listeners. Go to www.moundmatrix.org/page8.
Page 8.html.
That's the math study.
You have your circle there with the pentagram there. Mm-hmm. It's under the mound matrix.
For at the bottom of the page, on the left-hand side, I've given the reader a little glimpse at what the master grid pattern is in the United States. And when you dissect or pentsect the middle of that pentagram, all the towns in that area are called Five Points, Centerville, Center Point, and it's just very ironic.
Really?
Well, you
That's at the mound matrix one?
Right.
That's all we're all looking at?
Right.
I'll have to enlarge that somehow. How could we enlarge this so that we could see? Is there any way?
The main reason is that I'm not revealing everything, you know? I mean, I'm
by the book, right?
At some point, we still have to go there and find the Sipapu. Mm-hmm. You know, that is the theory then, that once we've found the true center point, that we will find a previously undiscovered cave entrance similar to the Mammoth or Flint Ridge system.
What origin point to start to get your circle pentagram?
The circle merely shows that it's an equilateral pentagram and that the points all are the same distance apart. That's merely corroborating data there. I had to find data, and we mentioned the author earlier, Pigeon.
Right, William Pigeon.
Right. There was a...
Yeah, you had to bear with me. Remember, I missed about 10 minutes of the show.
Cyrus Thomas and Squire and Davis were early researchers of the mounds throughout the 1870s and 80s, and there was a study finally published in 1890. I believe it's called the 13th Annual Report on the Bureau of Ethnology, and it's the only complete study of mounds prior to all the modern civilization destroying them through agricultural plowing and archaeological tomb raiding and pillaging. And, you know, just like Spiro, Oklahoma, they pillaged a treasure out of those mounds larger than King Tut's tomb.
Yeah, they did in New Mexico, that White Sands.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a big cage there worth billions from what I heard, and somebody had found that.
So that's kind of my boon to success in my research, is I have this talent for going back and finding really rare original data and then finding out how to plot that on maps accurately. And then, ultimately, I didn't want to trust my own hand, so I created a random database of these sites through longitude latitude references.
Uh-huh.
And turned it over to a petroleum company here in town and asked them to print it out on a large 3-foot by 5-foot map for me.
Uh-huh.
To see if it held up the fourth time it was done. And it did. Once again, the computer did show that all these geometric anomalies were there.
That's absolutely amazing.
I'm understanding your pentagram, but why did you call it matrix? I guess what I'm saying is, do you believe that the Matrix does have these mystical powers, that we could find portals there.
Okay, well, let's jump into that one step at a time. The Matrix itself is the grid pattern anomaly that's there,
mm-hmm.
but another study that I did was both with my mapping and the original Cyrus Thomas map from the 1890 study, was do a mylar overlay and see if there were horizontal and vertical lines akin to our own longitude-latitude system to see how they might have been able to pull this off. You know, and I found that within 5 degrees of our modern longitude-latitude system, these lines were all still there. There was a grid matrix pattern in the layout of these mounds, and you can still see it today just simply by mapping them out. So in my interpretation, look at the modern technology and just the challenges they have in making bigger, faster computers all the time. We go through tape loops and then silicone chips and all these different kinds of media. Now they're looking at crystals and they're using a laser to engrave it inside of a crystal. And the new formulas for chemically producing thin layers that when they crystallize, they create little circuits on their own. And the most recent is magnetic RAM memory. Because it's a magnet, it has its own electrical charge. And by simply, it's positive and negative, just like we use in binary computer codes, you can set those little nodules of positive and negative charge, I don't know if you call them electrons or what, you know, but the little fields within the magnet itself become data packets. And this is the latest, greatest method of storing information to where computers will finally be able to move fast enough to start using fuzzy logic and making intelligent decisions of their own. And now we have to look at the Earth itself. What is it? A huge magnet. And what are the ley lines? Are they possibly the magnetic force, the aura of the Earth itself? And if it's true of a magnet that it can have intelligence, you know, that even our very own blood cells have little magnets in them that help in the transfer of information, then why not the Earth itself?
So now we're going back to Gaia, right?
Having an intelligence. You know, look at nature and how everything we're talking about, the phi ratio, there's a force there. A nautilus shell doesn't grow in a perfect spiral by mistake. That is the phi ratio. The way a tree branches is at every 1.62 of the previous branch. You know, so it's all part of a fixed science or chemistry. Life was always here. You know, that this is a very unusual sphere. And I'm not saying we're the only one that, you know, supports life and has intelligence and all that, but this one is so unique. I mean, it has the largest moon of any orbiting body. And, you know, they interact together like some male-female energy, and it causes life to flourish and tides to roll and to clean things and sweep it clean. But we've maxed the planet out. You know, all of this industry, it takes 10 times the weight of a computer in fossil fuels and raw materials to make a computer. And yet we're churning them out like, you know, every 6 months you've got to have a new one. And this is what, you know, I've personally tried to strive to change in my life is all the disposability that we have. You know? The planet is losing species. It's losing pure water. Its weather patterns are upset. It's warming. There's just everything is in upheaval on this Earth, and it can't continue. It's got to get to a max point. And if that's where the Earth says, "Up, I'm turning the switch off now. We're going into a glacier age. You know, got too warm. I'm cooling it down." Then the Earth has to flush itself.
In other words, reboot. It's time to reboot.
Time to reboot, and that will mean, you know, a lot of surface changes. It's a very fragile environment. You know, we think of the Earth as such a solid mass, and you know, we're living on this thin crust on the surface that's as little as 5 miles thick in some areas, and then no more than 25 or 30 in other areas. You know, that, and it's always in a flux. You know, I mean, just a simple earthquake, people don't realize, oh, you know, I'm worried about an earthquake. I might fall in a crack in the earth. That's not what happens. When that low-frequency sound wave goes through from the earthquake tectonic plate release, it causes the dirt to turn to jelly for a minute. Those molecules of dirt separate, and you sink right into the earth, no matter where you're standing.
So it changes its molecular structure somewhat.
The density changes, and it doesn't support the weight. You know, I mean, water even has a surface tension. But when you break it, you know, I mean, when you fill a water glass past full, and it stays on top of the glass.
Well, it's like anything that's, if you vibrate it sufficiently, it's going to change form. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our bodies, if we know how to vibrate them properly, we could pass through matter.
Right.
Well, that's what I'm curious about. I think you have a very good point, Blue Otter, because this may be why it may be the purpose of the mounds themselves, is if there is these portals, or maybe there's some sort of harmonic sound waves that are resonated there, and that our ancients had knowledge of this. You know, they might have been able to use this to travel.
Hi friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you have been listening to our program for long, then you know that Mark the Badger Borcherding does a Mayan birth reading for each of our interview guests. Mark suggested that he give away a free reading for each donation of $20 or more to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a ministry of Oklahoma Native American Church, or the White Roots of Peace. So please support Prophecy Keepers Radio by making your free will offering at nativeamericanchurch.us, and you'll receive this gift reading. If you choose to make a recurring donation, once you've received your own reading, you can give readings away as free gifts. So why not head over to nativeamericanchurch.us and make an offering right now. Hope to be talking with you soon. Bye now.
I did a news story with the local ABC affiliate, and I was standing in front of the mouth of the cave, and when we played it back in slow motion, these balls of light were flying out of the cave behind me, and this was ABC News who shot this.
It's not my word.
So there were so many phenomena. You could go in the cave and someone would tap you on the shoulder and you'd turn around, there'd be no one there.
Now, they've talked about that down there at the Mammoth Cave in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a great story about the Mammoth Cave. Initially, it was just a guy out hunting rabbits. He shot and wounded a rabbit. It crawled into a hole, and he felt compelled not to leave the animal to suffer. So he crawled into the hole, and he discovered a cave that was 700 feet long and about 60 feet deep. Today, they've charted that cave, and it's called the Flint Bridge System now because it connects two mountains, and it's 640 miles long and goes 700 feet deep.
Well, there has also been a legend that that is one of the entrances to Shambhala.
To the underworld.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are explorers who have claimed to have gone into the Southwest and come up in northern South America. You know, that there's an entire network of systems. I think Tal Levesque is one of the researchers who's done a great deal of this, the interconnected systems. In my mapping, when I map the caves in the western United States, starting up in Montana and Wyoming, and some of those where they have the Whistling Cave and the Blowing Cave and the Wind Cave, when you map them out, they have perfectly straight lines in parallel running from north to south all the way to Mexico.
Well, now your ley lines run straight, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ley lines, I should say.
A friend of mine posited that during times of even flooding, that, it's kind of like if you were to take a glass of, just a drinking glass, and you hold it upside down and press it down into a bathtub, you know, there's going to be air in there, and the same would be true, say, if people knew a flood was coming and they're able to go down to the point where they could come back up land and be protected by the pressure of air from a flood.
And Mayan cave burials are done specifically on that theory that you just said. They have these rooms that are up and above the system that they know those bones will forever be preserved and kept dry. Because
right.
You know, they have these other chambers up and above the system.
Yeah, Thomas Mills will be talking about that. He's the one that wrote the book The Truth, which points out that the only animal symbols on the Giza Plateau are the symbols that are the most important to the Hopi religion. That is almost devoid of animal symbols except for Hopi religious symbols. And that the Great Pyramid may have been an escape place from flooding because the entrances are down low and you go down, but then once you're down in the pyramid you can go up, which would keep you give you a chance to survive. And that is indeed what he says is that several couples the culture knew the flood was coming. Several couples were prepared, food was prepared, and that in the Great Pyramid there's even the instructions on how to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And so that'll be an exciting show coming up in a few weeks.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we have this image of the pyramids and the sand and everything, but that's not what it was like back then. You know, it was a lush, heavy vegetated area with lots of rainfall, and it was a beautiful, lush climate. The term alchemy comes from the Chem Valley. You know, the every year the Nile would flood and bring in all these silts, which would turn it black, and that's what made it so fertile. You know, is that it brought all the nutrients to the plants. And the Arab Al-Jabir went to Egypt and worked with the pharaohs, and developed algebra and many of the other metallurgical sciences, you know, and that's where the term originated, alchemy and algebra and all that, from this, you know, early investigation.
That's absolutely amazing.
Now, why did you call it, why are you calling your site Mound Matrix? I'm curious about the matrix part, what your beliefs are there.
It is a matrix, a grid pattern that is geometrically laid out based on the phi ratio. And suppose I should go into that a little bit. The phi ratio is a mathematical of 1.62.
Oh.
It's actually 1.618171523.
Right.
But what we find in nature is that there is a mathematical formula that things are created based on. And to me, this is defining God herself, you know, that creation actually uses a set provable mathematical formula in creating things. So you take your index finger and you look at the three segments of the joints, and some are longer and shorter than the others, but two segments are 1.62, the ratio of one segment. This is also the basis of the Fibonacci numerical series, where it's 1, 3, 5, 8. You know, you take the previous number and add it to the last one, and you get your next digit. That's all got the phi ratio built into it. And the best example of this is the pentagram, or the five-pointed star, is geometrically created by using the phi ratio. I mean, you could just take a simple compass and set it in any setting you like and draw a round circle, and take that same width that you have now and make a mark at the top and put your pinpoint there and make another mark and go around and do that five times and simply connect those vertices and you have a five-pointed pentagram. You've perfectly dissected or pentsected that circle into five points. And what's beautiful about it is in the middle you get a pentagon. And there again, you merely connect the vertices and you get another pentagram. So that's what happens in the pattern of the Mound Matrix when you connect the dots of, you know, these sites, that you get these star-shaped patterns.
Someone might be able, here's a perfect example of it, listeners. Go to www.moundmatrix.org/page8.
Page 8. That's
HTML.
That's the math study.
You have your circle there with pentagram there. It's under the Mound Matrix.
We're at the bottom of the page on the left-hand side. right. I've given the reader a little glimpse at what the master grid pattern is in the United States. And when you dissect or pinsect the middle of that pentagram, all the towns in that area are called Five Points, Centerville, Center Point, and it's just very ironic.
Really?
Well,
that's at the Mound Matrix one?
Right.
That's what we're all looking at?
Right.
I'll have to enlarge that somehow. How could we enlarge this so that we could see?
Well,
is there any way?
The main reason is that I'm not revealing everything, you know? I mean, I'm
by the book, right?
at some point, we still have to go there and find the Sipapu. You know, that is the theory then, that once we've found the true center point, that we will find a previously undiscovered cave entrance similar to the Mammoth or Flint Ridge system.
What origin point to start to get your circle pentagram?
The circle merely shows that it's an equilateral pentagram and that the points all are the same distance apart. That's merely corroborating data there. I had to find data, and we mentioned the author earlier, Pigeon.
Right, William Pigeon.
Right. There was...
Yeah, you had to bear with me. Remember, I missed about 10 minutes of the show.
Okay. Cyrus Thomas and Squire and Davis were early researchers of the mounds throughout the 1870s and 80s, and there was a study finally published in 1890. I believe it's called the 13th Annual Report on the Bureau of Ethnology. And it's the only complete study of mounds prior to all the modern civilization destroying them through agricultural plowing and archaeological tomb raiding and pillaging. And, you know, just like Spiro, Oklahoma, they pillaged a treasure out of those mounds larger than King Tut's tomb.
Yeah, they did in New Mexico, of that White Sands. Yeah, there was a big cage there worth billions, from what I heard, and somebody had found that.
So that's kind of my boon to success in my research, is I have this talent for going back and finding really rare original data, and then finding out how to plot that on maps accurately, and then ultimately I didn't want to trust my own hands, so I created a random database of these sites through longitude latitude references and turned it over to a petroleum company here in town and asked them to print it out on a large 3-foot by 5-foot map for me to see if it held up the fourth time it was done. And it did. Once again, the computer did show that all these geometric anomalies were there.
That's absolutely amazing.
I'm understanding your pentagram, but why did you call it matrix? I guess what I'm saying is, do you believe that the matrix does have these mystical powers, that we could find portals there?
Okay, well, let's jump into that one step at a time. The matrix itself is the grid pattern anomaly that's there, but another study that I did was both with my mapping and the original Cyrus Thomas map from the 1890 study, was to do a mylar overlay and see if there were horizontal and vertical lines akin to our own longitude-latitude system to see how they might have been able to pull this off. You know, and I found that within 5 degrees of our modern longitude-latitude system, these lines were all still there. There was a grid matrix pattern in the layout of these mounds, and you can still see it today, just simply by mapping them out. So in my interpretation, look at the modern technology and just the challenges they have in making bigger, faster computers all the time. We go through tape loops and then silicone chips and all these different kinds of media. Now they're looking at crystals, and they're using a laser to engrave it inside of a crystal. And the new formulas for chemically producing thin layers that, when they crystallize, they create little circuits on their own. And the most recent is magnetic RAM memory. Because it's a magnet, it has its own electrical charge. can by simply, it's positive and negative, just like we use in binary computer codes. You can set those little nodules of positive and negative charge, the, I don't know if you call them electrons or what, you know, but the little fields within the magnet itself become data packets. And this is the latest, greatest method of storing information to where computers will finally be able to move fast enough to start using fuzzy logic and making intelligent decisions of their own. And now we have to look at the Earth itself. What is it? A huge magnet. And what are the ley lines? Are they possibly the magnetic force, the aura of the Earth itself? And if it's true of a magnet that it can have intelligence, you know, that even our very own blood cells have little magnets in them that help in the transfer of information, then why not the Earth itself?
So now we're going back to Gaia, right?
Having an intelligence. You know, look at nature and how everything we're talking about, the phi ratio, there's a force there. A nautilus shell doesn't grow in a perfect spiral by mistake. That is the phi ratio. The way a tree branches is at every 1.62 of the previous branch. You know, so it's all part of a fixed science or chemistry. Life was always here. You know, that this is a very unusual sphere. And I'm not saying we're the only one that, you know, supports life and has intelligence and all that, but this one is so unique. I mean, it has the largest moon of any orbiting body, and you know, they interact together like some male-female energy, and it causes life to flourish and tides to roll and to clean things and sweep it clean, but we've maxed the planet out. You know, all of this industry, it takes 10 times the weight of a computer in fossil fuels and raw materials to make a computer. And yet we're churning them out like, you know, every 6 months you've got to have a new one. And this is what, you know, I've personally tried to strive to change in my life is all the disposability that we have. You know? The planet is losing species. It's losing pure water. Its weather patterns are upset. It's warming. There's just everything is in upheaval on this Earth, and it can't continue. It's got to get to a max point. And if that's where the Earth says, "Up, I'm turning the switch off now, we're going into a glacier age, you know? Got too warm, I'm cooling it down." Then the Earth has to flush itself.
In other words, reboot. It's time to reboot.
Time to reboot, and that will mean, you know, a lot of surface changes. It's a very fragile environment. You know, we think of the Earth as such a solid mass, and, you know, we're living on this thin crust on the surface that's as little as 5 miles thick in some areas, and then no more than 25 or 30 in other areas. You know that, and it's always in a flux. You know, I mean, just a simple earthquake, people don't realize, oh, you know, I'm worried about an earthquake. I might fall in a crack in the earth. That's not what happens. When that low-frequency sound wave goes through from the earthquake tectonic plate release, it causes the dirt to turn to jelly for a minute. Those molecules of dirt separate, and you sink right into the earth, no matter where you're standing.
So it changes its molecular structure.
The density changes, and it doesn't support the weight. You know, I mean, water even has a surface tension. But when you break it, you know, I mean, when you fill a water glass past full, and it stays on top of the glass.
Well, it's like anything that's, if you vibrate it sufficiently, it's going to change form. And, you know, our bodies, if we know how to vibrate them properly, we could pass through matter.
Right.
Well, that's what I'm curious about. I think you have a very good point, Blue Otter, because this may be why, it may be the purpose of the mounds themselves, is if there is these portals, or maybe there's some sort of harmonic sound waves that are resonated there, and that our ancients had knowledge of this, you know, they might have been able to use this to travel.
Friends, this is Will Blue Otter, encouraging you to obtain an authorized participant or AP card and become a federally recognized Native religious practitioner. Presently, Oklava Native American Church is the only Native American church spiritually blessed by the Rosebud Reservation Native American Church and has a certificate of existence in the state of Utah that is authorized to worship on or off tribal grounds and has met the standard of sincerity and vow of poverty standards in the state of Utah and federal courts. This card is designed to assist all people regardless of their racial makeup, political affiliation, social and/or financial status, and receiving their constitutional rights. This card is also designed to assist United States judicial officials to honor their solemn oath to protect and exercise the principles of the United States Constitution while carrying out their duty and serving their fellow citizens. To join the movement that is strengthening and exercising the principles of the United States Constitution, please obtain your AP card by visiting NativeAmericanChurch.us today.
With this one here in Wisconsin, it was next to one of the, there's a bunch of effigy mounds right in that area. And it seems like many of these here in the United States are close to these mounds.
And in the circles themselves, the complex geometric formulas that it takes to execute those frequently, again, are based on the fire issue, but some may show a DNA pattern layout or, the spiral, the double helix spiral. Others, there was a period in 2002 where I believe a lot of pentagrams were coming up in different forms inside these crop circles.
Yeah.
Really complex patterns. And so I believe that they are a language of some kind trying to be communicated to us that is...
Well, I don't know if the crop circles themselves are the ones that's creating this harmonic or creating the harmonic waves, or if it's because they were put there, it pulled that energy. Maybe this was an energy point. And so it's like when you hit, you remember when you said you was in that cave and you hit that rock and all of a sudden it made that sound?
Yeah, you also made me think of another thing. We're talking about the interaction of energies. And there's a real mystical place in Kansas. It's the only place you can get these particular crystals. They're round, and they're called Bogee stones because they're from the Bogee Mound in Kansas. And when they have a positive and negative polarity, the different stones, so they call them male and female. And if you put two opposite polarity Bogee stones together, they will grow in size.
Yeah.
It's amazing that rocks can do that.
Yeah.
That's how they became crystals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, like I said, on my site, I have information on how that how that happens.
Apparently they're placed in gardens, and they allow, they're allowed to disintegrate into the soil. Helps, it's interesting. They're used in gardening. You ever hear about that use?
No, I hadn't really.
Yeah, crystals are often used in a garden grid to help the growth and health of the plants.
Well, since we are, all silica-based, everything on the planet is some 90-95% silicas, which are crystals. That makes perfect sense. That would break down. I mean, we need it, again, going back to our environment, the methyl sulfides and all these things that are normally present in a good, healthy soil, and it gets transferred into the food, and it helps us rejuvenate and keep our youth and our health. Those things are gone out of the water and the soil.
Well, Ron, my wife and I lived in a sandstone cave that, actually, we had a friend that leased on a yearly basis a square mile from the state of Utah, and on that cave was about a half mile long piece of sandstone that was about 400 feet high at the highest point. It looked like, from the side, from the top, it looked like a giant tortoise turning counterclockwise. And my friend mined out five holes and built a bed and breakfast. Several homes. Ran a generator of about 5 hours at night, and we charged up batteries. But during the night and during the morning, there was absolutely no electrical fields, nothing running. And when we'd wake up, we'd always hear that hum of Mother Earth. And I was able to hear volume spikes, but Betty was able to hear just the tone. And first time we heard it, I hummed it to her. She said, yeah, that's the pitch. And the only thing I could think of is all that quartz that was in that red sandstone out there in the around Moab, Utah. I know people have seen the pictures of Arches National Park, and that, but that's real close to where we lived. And a lot of gold also in that red sand.
Many people are reacting to these earth frequencies, these tones that are coming out. Some communities are actually funding research projects now because so many people are complaining about it. They're saying it's a good 30-36% of the population is sensitive to these harmonics that are coming out of it.
Well, look at the Tahoe's hum.
Mm-hmm. There's another great example. The town council actually approved a budget to look into it and find out what's going on there.
Did they find out anything, Gino?
It's just recently approved.
Oh, okay.
Currently in the study. You know, we got to find out that the government's got a big boring machine down there and they're making their own passageways and highways, you know, and cave systems, or you know, that the Earth is giving off a frequency, or, you know, what exactly is it? I mean,
well, we've got pictures of those boring machines on our site, so, I mean, they do exist, you know. And from what I hear, they're trying to take the tunnels that connect them to the ancient sites that's underground.
Well, I noticed that after memorizing, see, the other day I sang a song to my wife. It just popped into my head. I had not heard. See, I was a professional singer for a few years, and apparently I still have my natural or my perfect relative pitch. You can't just tell me to sing a middle C and I can sing it, but. But I sang the song to her, then I went into my song, then I downloaded a clip of it off the net, and it was the exact same pitch. So I remember that pitch that I heard while sleeping there at Rockland Ranch. The next time I heard the temple bells and the Tibetan monks chanting, I went, that's the pitch. And I suddenly came to realize, hey, that sound that they're intoning is the pitch of Mother Earth. I never did investigate to see exactly, you know, how many hertz it was or what it translated into as far as...
Can you tell us about overtones?
Well, overtones, are you talking about harmonics?
Yes.
Well, harmonics occur at every fifth, seventh, and twelfth from a tonic. Say you've got a... Let's say you've got a guitar string, and... when I tune my guitar, I don't even use frets to tune it. I use harmonics to tune it, provided the guitar's intonation-wise is perfect. But if you just touch a guitar string in the very center, which is at the 12th fret, and just very lightly tap it, you'll get a bell-like tone. And you'll also get the 5th and the 7th by touching but not pressing down on the strings. And they're a much more precise way of tuning and listening to an instrument. But
so now you're at a harmonic frequency now. In the overtone is where two tones blend together and make a third tone, which we can actually do, you know, like in an Om chant, you know, where you're bringing it out through the mouth and nose, and it actually creates a third tone.
Right. It's not exactly what you call a harmony, but it's an overtone. That's something that's kind of magical in music that's created. When I was a music major, I was taught that the master composers make good use of overtones, and it kind of came into its own with the piano, because the piano has so many strings. You know, there's two or three strings for each note. And the way it's tuned, it's not tuned perfectly, it's tempered. Really all you have to do is just walk up to a piano and just kind of hit it with your fist and listen very carefully, and it will ring, and you can hear all kinds of interesting things. If you put a microphone or something on a piano and did that and turned it up, It'd be very interesting.
Well, that would be my allegory for these earth tones that we're hearing, you know, that it's all the different energies and forces interacting together. You think about how much we're bombarded with just radio frequency, RF, you know, with all the television and radio and two-way communications going on. Our airwaves are just filled with stuff, and you can't touch it or hear it without a device, but it's obviously going through us. And, you know, when you're holding a radio, you know, the reception improves, so you are an antenna and receiving these frequencies. So the Earth is under all these forces and pressures, you know, and there's all these different geological materials, you know, quartz and gold and all these things that are being squeezed and pressed. And, you know, that coupled with the already existing magnetic fields and forces, it's got to be something that, you know, those people are becoming sensitive to it. But we've been in this Aquarian age for some time now, and you know, waiting for the planet to wake up to it. So if we have about a third of the people hearing it now, that's good, I guess.
Okay, now you have here, where is it, that the Earth or the magnetic polarity reverses from positive to negative in 3,000 year cycles.
That's really an interesting observation made in the deep sea trench in the Atlantic Ocean, where the two plates come together out in the middle between Europe and the United States. The plates are separating, and as the magma comes up and cools, it cools in whatever magnetic flux state the Earth is in at the time. Currently, we're in a positive polarity. You know, we use negative as a ground. Every 3,000 years, something causes these bands to reverse in their polarity charge. And there are 11 recorded bands that they've acknowledged that exist down there, you know, on both sides of the trench. So something is causing a flip, and it's a regular cyclical pattern. And it just happens to be long enough ago that it's not in our modern recorded history, you know, that we weren't noticing, you know, that our batteries didn't work right 3,000 years ago. Although in Baghdad, perhaps they did, if you're familiar with the Baghdad battery.
Yeah, yeah.
2,600-year-old relic that would produce electricity with just grape juice in a clay jar with a lead ring and a copper sleeve. You know, and it would put out 1 volt of electricity. Recorded pictographs in Egyptian tombs and Mayan alike that show some kind of light bulb-looking device in their hands. But so what would cause this? You know, you'd have to be some kind of astronomer, I suppose, to see if the planets all line up every 3,000 years. We make a precessional orbit around our solar system every 28,000. I wonder if you divide that by 3,000, what you've got. So it's a given fixed phenomenon that has happened. As far as where we are relative to the last flip, I'm not sure at this point in time.
Well, basically, all we have to do is figure out, we'll take back history as far as we possibly can, which is almost impossible because everybody has their own idea of when summer actually existed. And of course, there's a lot of those civilizations that may have existed. I see here that you agree with Blue Otter and I feel, that many actually went underground into the tunnel systems, into the caves, and so they would have survived, and then eventually came back up again.
Right, and more journey to the center of the Earth sort of systems is what I picture, you know, where they found a whole civilization may have thrived down there for, you know, hundreds or thousands of years.
And who's to say that they're not still surviving?
Exactly. You know, there are phenomena where certain types of bacteria, we know fireflies, you know, collect this bacteria and they give off light, so why not, you know, the same thing existing in caves that would allow a culture to live in some kind of normal environment.
Well, you know, I've brought that up to people and I said, oh, well, that can't happen because of the fact that there's no food down there. You know, you can't grow vegetation. But that's not true.
Mushrooms do very well.
You betcha.
I frequently find sprouts of plants and seeds that have been washed down in the caves. They go ahead and germinate and root out and go as long as they can, you know, with their energy.
And we do know that there are species down there. I mean, there's we found fish into these deep down into these caves in these lakes.
I'm frequently rivers. Encountering white crawdads that no longer have eyes.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had, when I lived out near Moab, Utah, there were some very deep eroded places that the creeks would run into, and you know, my son and I would sometimes go in there and take a little raft down in there to get away from a hot day, and sometimes 20 and 30 feet deep. And we got down in there noticing that it smelled pretty fishy. We noticed that, you know, guess what? There were pigmentless crawdads, you know, in the middle of the desert there. Plus, there's a place in East Tennessee called the Lost Sea. And it was, in the old days, it was a guano mine for the Confederate Army. And now it was a speakeasy for a while, but now it's a commercial cave, and they have trout in that lake that are blind and have absolutely no pigment.
Mm-hmm. And yet they thrive.
Yeah. Well, they do fine. Yeah, they see
well,
tourist people.
Yeah, and so I mean, we do have evidence that things do survive down there. Fish survive, animals survive. We got the bass; they thrive very well, you know. I don't know what all type of species have you encountered when you were in the caves.
Well, let's see. It's
or vegetation, even.
Yeah, it's based on how far you go in, but let's say once you're past, you know, any permeable light coming into the cave system, then it is mostly aquatic, you know, fish and crustaceans and things of that form. But there are still plenty of flies and gnats and things that these species can feed on, and you know, just a wonderful array of corals and. You know, they were once a living matter, you know, that they form fan shapes, and it's just an amazing world down there. You know, the stalactites and the stalagmites and
And of course, let's say that civilizations did survive down there during some great catastrophes. They had moved down into the inner world and survived. And through time, you know, as the very, you know, the different generations were born into that type of a world, naturally, they would, and even the people that went down there, after a while, they would become accustomed to the darkness, their eyesights would adapt to, or their visions would adapt to the darkness, and then as their children, you know, the different generations were born, you know, they would probably evolve according to the environment that they were born into.
And, you know,
Prophecy Keeper, Prophecy Keeper.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Folks, the scriptures say, "My people perish for lack of knowledge." We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection.
You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all past Prophecy Keepers interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keepers does need money to continue to operate. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look.
Keepers of great wisdom, truth of other times, let the wind blow.
A lot of times caves are turned into hatcheries and farms for different kinds of plants that do better in that environment. Mushrooms is a fine example. You know, a completely nutritious food that you can grow huge varieties of them and gain all of the amino acids and proteins and everything you needed from those. But I think at some point, this energy itself from living in that environment would substitute the body's food needs. That we are so programmed to eat three times a day and you need 8 glasses of water and all this, but you look at Tibetan monks that can, you know, thrive on next to nothing and have extended fasts, you know, as part of their spiritual enlightenment.
Yeah, eating the prana.
And mana is a very interesting thing. This has come up, you know, I've read about it in the Bible. I'm thinking maybe it's relating to something called monoatomic gold.
Yeah.
Gold itself has been a focal point of cultures for at least 9 to 10,000 years now. A very complex thing to extract from the earth and process down and smelt and finally refine into a product that's usable as a product. And yet they figured this out, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago.
Well, I had heard something about, there was a story about Moses and the golden calf. I don't know if you had heard it or not, but if you really read it, what it does, it says that he actually changed the, it changed into a powder. When he when they cooked it down or whatever, they smelted it down, it changed changed the molecular structure into a powdered form.
You mean the people drank it? They couldn't.
Well, no, they put. Well, it turned into a powdered form, and a powdered form of gold is what the ancients, or well, actually, what we're calling it today, is a starfire, and starfire would have been the mana.
And in Europe, you know, 200 years ago, they call it the, or more, they call it the philosopher's stone.
Yeah.
So the story went that this is how Saint Germain was able to, every 70 years, he would ingest the powder, and his teeth would fall out. He'd lose all of his hair and lose his outer layer of skin, and everything would grow back, and he would appear to be, you know, about 25 years old.
Yeah.
And that's how he was able to, yeah, I guess that's where the Highlander, the whole idea of somebody that lives, you know, pretty much forever.
Well, if we could turn around, if they do have, and I think that they do, there's gold down there,
sure.
And they could change the gold, because, I mean, they would have taken their knowledge at that point in time with them. And so, yeah, they could have they could be using the starfire to live off of.
You look at the metal itself, and on a chemical level, it has 4 atoms at its nucleus, which are so tightly bound together that they're virtually impossible to split. And that's called a noble metal because of that noble bond that's so hard to break. And to get it down to 3 atoms or triatomic, and then down to 2 atoms, diatomic, and then by the time it's down to 1 atom in its nucleus, it's called monoatomic gold. And that's what I believe mana is. You know, the Kilauea volcano kicks out 300 pounds of it a day in its eruptions, but they just can't figure out how to harvest it. But, you know, at that point, it can permeate the cell wall and be an ingested organic material into the body. And gold, you know, when it's in its natural state, you know, it's got these 4 atoms. It has a wild card electron that escapes its orbital sphere and achieves a new higher orbit when it's exposed to light. And these wild card electrons absorb that light. It's sort of a spiritual metaphor, and it takes on that light, knowledge, wisdom, whatever you want to call it, and gives it off again in the form of luster. And that's what makes the metal itself so desirable on a commercial level or economic level. But, you know, it, when we think about that, it's pretty amazing. It's almost living, you know. It's seeking light. But that mana that, for example, the Hebrews survived on as they wandered the deserts for 40 years, you know, this has come up consistently over time and in the past. And there's supposed to be natural earth deposits of this mana down, you know, in the earth. So could be the actual material, you know, that they survived on, you know, while they were in these periods of recession into the inner world.
Well, now we also have the stories of gnomes. Well, we call them taros, and there's daros, but anyhow, it's been the people in the Middle Ages would have called like gnomes, fairies, the dwarfs, possibly, and of course now we have Bigfoot.
By the way, this is very underpublicized, but the University of Idaho did go public and say that they had found clinical scientific evidence to prove that they had found a place where a Bigfoot had bedded down for the night. They got a complete body cast and hairs, and they ran DNA testing on it and found that it was neither ape or human. So they came out public year before last and made this statement, and it was about 2 days in the media, and then you never heard it again.
Where was this at? What university?
University of Idaho.
University of Idaho, and they put this out when?
About 2 years ago.
2 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, where did they find it, did they say?
Believe it was in Idaho.
Well, the government knows.
I'll have to, if you could by any chance find that article or know of anybody that has that article, or listeners, if you have that article, please send it to us at our email address, Suterla, that's Suterla, at speeddial.net. Or to make it nice and simple, just go burlingtonnews@yahoo.com.
Well, I know the Air Force Academy, they give their instructions to sentries that if they encounter a Bigfoot, and if they shoot them, that they would be charged with murder. So,
mm-hmm.
As far as I've always known, we're still looking for evidence of one. And you say that that university has done the DNA testing and everything. So they said that the DNA testing shows that it was not animal or human.
Neither ape nor human. Yeah.
Species unknown.
Unto itself, and we were talking earlier about these giants.
Yeah.
So perhaps their only recourse to escape the persecution of the smaller people.
Yeah.
You know, this is going back to Cro-Magnon times, you know.
Yeah.
We had Homo sapien, Homo erectus, Homo habilis, you know, and it was always the smaller species that were better with their hands and tool making that conquered the larger races.
Maybe they are the Nephilim that we descend from.
Well, no, because the DNA is not showing it.
Well, they would, if they were able to, if they had close enough DNA that they were able to mate with us, or if there were enough that was sufficiently mutated that he or they may have been able to.
But it would still show up in the DNA somehow. The man part would have shown up.
Among a larger category of other types of larger humans and other species that, you know, once thrived on the planet. You know, we've touched Karankawas and the Gulf Coast and the red-headed mummies in Montana.
Well,
end of part one. Part two will air tomorrow evening.
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Hi friends, this is Will Blue Otter. I have a message here from 1975 from John Wayne. It comes right out of today's headlines. So you Indian folks who are following the progressive trend in politics, You're following the people that supported slavery. You're following the people that have enslaved you ever since the Civil War. Listen to John Wayne.
You know, it's a funny thing, the Indians now. This AIM group have started something that now they're against me for some reason. But I am the only man in pictures that always gave them their human dignity. I never was in a picture. I never allowed myself at any time to do anything that would take their human dignity away from them. And that, to me, is the most important thing in a man. I have found that a certain type that calls himself a liberal, and I always thought I was a liberal. I came up terribly surprised one time when I found that I was a right-wing conservative extremist. When I have listened to everybody's point of view that I ever met, and then decide how I should feel. I mean, but this so-called new liberal group, Jesus, they never listen to your point of view, and they make a decision as to what you think, and they're articulate enough and in control of enough of the press to force that image out for the average person. For some reason, maybe it's these pictures, they have not been able to do that with me. In spite of what they say, people have not taken sides that I'm a, you know, it hasn't affected my career in popularity, let's say. In spite of the fact that they've tried to make it do it. There isn't a hell of a lot that we can do to change human behavior. We keep making laws to try and change human behavior. You can't do it. I think you can accept it and feel how you would feel in that position. You're being conned into Keynesianism and socialism now. But it isn't going to stop the selfishness of human behavior. It isn't going to stop the greed. If you take $20 and give a dollar to every son of a bitch in a room and come back a year later, one of the bastards will have most of the money. I mean, it's just human nature, and you're not going to whip it with a lot of laws. I think when you make people conscious, as communication gets better, and you make people conscious of somebody in trouble, starving or something like that, the average person will help. But of course now they've got so damn many charities, and there's so much professionalism. You know, there's if you have a charity, you hire some professionals to work up the charity. By the time you get the money, you get $4 for the recipient and $400 for the administrators. So, I mean, Christ, I think there are people who try to affect a thinking where they know more than some other son of a bitch and try to put a false impression on what human nature is. Christ's sakes, we have proven that we go back to hope at the first opportunity. Just throw out a little fish and bam, they're out there ready to grab it. So we are optimistic. We have to be optimistic. Christ, what else would there be in life if you lose optimism?
Let the truth be known to all mankind. Prophecy keeper,
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius.
Let the truth